man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Hey, 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 everybody. It's another episode of Who Shot Ya. I'm your host, Iffy Wadiway, and in the booth with me are my friends that I love so much. But first up, we'll intro film reviews editor at The Wrap, Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, what's good?
Well, Iffy, today, the day that we are recording this, is the 30th anniversary of the release of the landmark They Might Be Giants album, Flood. And the album itself is great, so that's a good thing. Yeah. But the other cool thing is that I hadn't listened to it in at least 20 years. And I started listening to it today, and it's one of those things where I listened to that record in my car on cassette so many times when it was new that even going back to it 20-plus years later, I knew at least 85% of the words of every song. Like the
which is a lot because they have 20,000 songs. Exactly. Words
they're
a song.
Like the Sondheim of blah, 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 blah. Yeah, like neural pathways that had just lied dormant for who knows how long just came right back to life. It was astonishing to me how, like, a thing that I was obsessed with and then walked away from, I was right back in it.
Oh, no, I felt that every time I go back and listen to My Chemical Romance and From Autumn to Ashes. definitely, you're into screamo too, right?
Well, that's more of my shoegaze period. So.
My transporter is Beastie Boys.
Ooh.
I'm also, it's incapable of not rap singing along.
Yeah.
I know what you mean, that you're like, I shouldn't remember all of these words.
And it's just like,
there they are. Taking up space somewhere.
Yeah, you're like, I can't remember my daughter's name, but somehow
this filing cabinet is still in there.
Yeah. Also, that other voice you heard was producer and film festival programmer, Drea Clark. Drea, what's good?
That other voice butting in. Yeah. Getting her 2 cents worth. What's good with me is Cheer on Netflix. It is a 6-part documentary that I did not know I would have any interest in, and then started watching with some friends and then skipped all other plans, and we watched it in its entirety over a weekend. It is about a junior college in Texas and the competitive cheer program they have there, and that they're national champions, like dominating. They've been national champions for 15 years or something, entirely because of their very small, very firm but fair coach, Monica. And the subjects that they choose amongst the team are perfection, and it has that sports doc shape to it. So you watch them come together. You get to know little, like, oh, there's this guy I cried several times. As you know, I love crying at documentaries. There's the kid every one of the ones that they follow have horrible backstories, like just heartbreak in different unexpected ways. And they've become a family as a team. And it also is riveting to watch because, unlike most sports thing, I can understand what they're doing for cheer. And what that is insane things with their bodies. There were numerous shots where I thought they were showing things in reverse slow motion, but they're not. They're just doing the weirdest, like climbing onto this girl's shoulders from this angle that shouldn't work because physics. Anyway, Cheer, I highly recommend it. Ooh. It was so good. It put me in a very competitive but happy frame of mind.
This is the second like program I've been on where somebody has recommended this.
So. For real? Yeah.
Yeah, Katie Walsh, we did a case chart everything on Friday. Loved it too, so I got to check this out.
All right, I'm in good company.
See what's up with the cheer, you know? Oh, and that voice you have not heard yet.
Because he's not a Budinsky like some people.
Waiting in the shadows to strike with great takes and fun.
No pressure.
Cinematographer and director of the movie Banana Split, Benjamin Kalsuki. What's good?
Hi. What's good? My what's good is probably going to show some ignorance and it's going to show some anticipation. I very recently figured out that the French film Les Miserables that's coming out is not that Les
Miserables. It's not a Victor Hugo,
And love Victor Hugo, don't ever need to see another version of that story for the rest of my
life.
Saw the trailer, cannot wait. So
excited.
It's
real good.
It looks totally awesome.
I'll tell you, though, I will say this. The 1995 Les Miserables, which has never been released on DVD and makes me insane, that stars Jean-Paul Belmondo, is only half Victor Hugo and then half set in World War II, and it's awesome. And if you ever get the chance to see it, it's great.
So this new one is not the
It's a contemporary French film, and I would actually recommend, if you're in for it, in for a penny, in for a pound, I would do a double feature of Mathieu Kassovitz's La Haine.
La Haine, yeah.
And I do La Haine into Les Miserables. And the new one, it's really well done. I will always resent it a little because it was France's film for the Academy Awards this year. Instead of Portrait of a Lady on
that's
Fire,
that
put a tally for me for that film. Oh. So I have a little but it was also, I was like, oh, isn't it nice to see other countries' cops be terrible to people of color? How refreshing.
And they do throw in some Victor Hugo quotes, lest we think it's separated
not
at all.
Hugo.
But no, nobody steals any bread, and no, it's fine. Iffy, what's good?
Oh, man. What's good with me is... Look, I've been playing Red Dead Online, which is the Red Dead Redemption 2. Finally came to PC.
I've played Red Dead Redemption.
All right. So
just saying.
It's one of the best Westerns I've ever played. But you get to be online and you get to be a cowboy and you, work with other people in your posse. And so, you're just, running around and, I made a cowboy. And, because I'm, a turbo nerd who's also a writer, I always have to put too much thought into it. So my character's name was Chike Bogart. And he's, a Nigerian guy who's...
Cool.
Who was captured in the last throes of the transatlantic slave, and he escaped, and now he's on the West trying to be a cowboy and get his life together.
Amazing.
I gotta say, and whenever I do bounty hunting missions, I wear all red and a duster. And he was like, "Yeah, that's because he gets too bloody. He never gives you the chance to run away,
or he's too lazy to do laundry.
Yeah,
after he's done killing."
And then I found out, my guy, because I was like, because he had a bowler hat when he's off duty, and that's what I named the, and people don't know he's the same person. I was like, oh, that's just Trigun, the anime. So just lots of nerdy references for all of y'all to digest.
Well, if you didn't get nerdy references, I thought you were going to say you were making my posse don't do homework jokes, and they were landing on deaf ears, perhaps.
Wait, so is it called Red Dead Redemption 2?
Yeah, Red Dead.
Okay,
Redemption.
So it's not Red Dead 2. It's a second of the redemptions.
Yeah, because it was Red Dead Revolver was the first
one. Yes.
But today, we're talking about 1917. And fun fact, no gifts on Giphy, because when Alonzo was trying to get here, I was trying to do the scene where he's running and go, Alonzo trying to get here. So my cute joke, gone. Thanks, Giphy. We'll also discuss some other long one-take films and, of course, staff picks. But first, it's time for our new segment called In a Dick, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a new segment and answer the question, Is This Important? Do I Care? And first up, we're talking about the Academy Award nominations. You know, they dropped this past week, and there's so much to discuss. And it's less, is this important and do you care, but what is important and what do you care about?
Well, obviously, we sensed it might be coming, and it did come true, that there's no women nominated in director is a frustrating omission. There are... to me, a number of worthy candidates.
Yeah.
The ones that we've talked a lot about have been, obviously, Greta Gerwig for Little Women. Who else did we
Celine Sciamma.
We had a whole thing. I know, but her film was...
Celine Dion?
No, Celine Sciamma, who did Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Yeah. Maria Heller from A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
Marielle
Heller, sorry.
Yeah, Alma Harrell.
Honey Boy. Maureen Scafaria for Hustlers.
Olivia Wilde for Booksmart.
Yeah.
Lulu Wong for
That's the other main one I was thinking of. So... it was a...
Did I read somewhere that there were actually more female nominees this year than in years past in terms of, other tech categories and stuff?
I think so. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me.
Not that absolves the director branch.
Yeah.
But it's also, I think, again, it's this thing we've talked about in the past of this film solidifies that idea, especially when you look at Best Picture as well, of what the Academy considers... an Oscar-worthy film.
Yeah.
And it's both... the films that end up in Best Picture are 1917, which we're talking about today. I watched this film before nominations and I was like, oh yeah, this is an Oscar film. Like, you make this film sort of assuming, the studio is assuming that will be nominations coming. And it's ingrained in us, it's ingrained in the industry and in the members of the Academy of like, what is worthy of that kind of consideration? And often female stories are not. And then there's subcategories of that too, of marginalized stories are, you might get an acting nod.
Right.
But you're not going to be in the big game or
but
whatever.
But like, you know, Jacqueline Coley had a great thing on Twitter talking about how of the 35, 36 black women who have been nominated for lead actress or supporting actress, there's something like 24 of them were either slaves or impoverished women
or
maids. Yeah. And how like basically...
including the solo nominee this year.
Exactly,
yeah.
Cynthia Erivo for Harriet, which is a movie that people did not feel strongly about it. I don't think the Academy felt very strongly about it either.
Yeah, at this point, it really did feel like, we got to throw one in there.
Like, I mean, somebody even said, like, the idea of the one acting nominee of color being somebody who played Harriet Tubman feels like a joke from the critic.
It does.
But in a larger sense, like, the idea of, like, black women get nominated for Pain, and that's it. That's the one note they're allowed to play in this.
Well, and black films that are, you know, because we've looked at the ones that are considered Academy Award worthy, and you have your 12 Years of Slave. You have, that was the most pointed thing. Like, as you know, I was really, really hoping to see Lupita Nyong'o in there for us,
right.
Which she had two incredible performances in.
Yeah.
And the most astute thing I saw was that the Academy was happy to reward her when she was playing a slave and not as much when she was playing this very different, very nuanced role.
Also, it just feels like the Academy, I think just even that first point of like the quote unquote Oscar movie, because I think there was just all in all a lot of great performances in horror movies that were overlooked. Like, you know, Florence getting it for Little Woman instead of Midsommar.
Right. But it's also not uncommon when somebody has multiple roles in a year, they're going to go with the path of least resistance. And mind you, I love Florence Pugh in Little Women. I think she's brilliant. I hope, you know, I'm thrilled that she's nominated, but you're right. It's sort of like when they gave an Oscar to Alicia Vikander for being in The Danish Girl, but it was really because she was in Ex Machina that year, but they weren't going to nominate her for that. You know, I mean, my favorite example is when they nominated Dennis Hopper for Hoosiers Year of Blue Velvet, you know?
Wait, really?
Really.
Amazing.
Yeah. Or for that matter, nobody remembers this movie, but the year that Whoopi Goldberg won for Ghost, she was in this really terrific film about the Montgomery bus boycott called The Long Walk Home, opposite Sissy Spacek, that Michael Apted directed. And it's her best performance, but the one they gave her the Oscar for was the flashier one in the more sort of studio-friendly movie, which was Ghost.
It's got the marketing campaign cash behind it.
And that's the other thing, too. You know, again, like we discussed last week, everybody on this list is because there's a lot of, like, they had backers that were willing to, like, put forth the money to get them into the conversation and make sure they got seen by the people that needed to see it and advertise the people they needed to advertise it to. And, you know, there is an entire podcast called This Had Oscar Buzz, because there are a lot of, because as much as there are movies that, yes, fit the parameters, a lot of movies get made in those parameters then don't get any nominations anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, like, how many For Your Consideration things did we see for The Aeronauts?
Yeah.
You know, and that got nothing.
But that's like BAFTA bait. I mean, that's for the other side of the
this
pond.
This is true, I suppose.
BAFTA bait. That sweet, sweet BAFTA
so
bait.
We jokingly
used
came up with, exactly, we manifested into the universe our idea of what would an American remake of Parasite look like and who would be cast in it. And sorry.
They literally announced the next day.
The next day after we recorded it, Bong Joon-ho is teaming up with writer-director Adam McKay to make a limited TV series version of Parasite for HBO. Hmm. Although an American remake of Parasite is a horrifying idea to many. Bong had this to say about the project to Deadline, quote, "I really liked Adam McKay's The Big Short, and I loved his sense of humor and the sharp satire he conveyed about the current American politics. With Parasite, while I was writing the script, I had so many more ideas I couldn't convey in the two-hour running time of the film. I knew that if I had a longer running time, I'd be able to tell those stories, and that's what I plan to talk about with Adam pretty soon," unquote. So, yeah, it's not going to be what we feared necessarily, but is this important? Do you care?
I think it's important in the sense of you know, the commerce element of art is always very real, and maybe sometimes it's nice to be reminded of that. I will say I am relieved that it's going to be a limited series versus an Americanized reboot, like, movie.
Right.
Because that, other than the cash grab, that said, Director Bonk, get that money. Like, I'm not, I'm never going to, you
know. Make 20 more movies with
it. Yes, please. Yeah. But I do believe that there are stories there similar, like they've been working on the Snowpiercer adaptation that's just coming out now, like next month, for a year or something. Yeah. So I know, I have faith in him as a creator, and if it's broader world building and more avenues, it's the like straight up remake that, you know, chills even my DNA.
I'm waiting for Netflix to do the children's animated series of Okja.
Stop it. Oh my God, stop it.
But it is interesting because, like, if you're going to make an American version of that world, like, that thing that's fascinating about that movie is, like, I don't know what it looks like for a Korean family to fall through the cracks. I know what that story looks like in America. Mm-hmm. And it is, I'm curious to see what they do with it. But yeah, I think 8 hours tops, you're good. All and right. with the right directors, I mean, that's,
And I kind of liked him pairing with Adam McKay. That was an unexpected for that film of, you know, we were talking, our dream director for a remake that should never happen was Sean Baker.
Nice.
And Adam McKay, having said that, I totally understand the appeal of that fit.
Yeah, I mean, especially if we're doing, if they end up doing like what y'all pitch, which is the Black family, I'm going to audition for it. So that's like
very high for me. Yeah,
very
high. Keep an eye out.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking about 1917 just as soon as we hear from another one of the shows on Maximum Fun.
Hey gang, Jesse here, the founder of Maximum Fun, and with me is Stacey Molsky, who is, among other things, the lady who responds to all of your tweets.
Hi everyone, I also send you newsletters.
So anyway, something really awesome. You, Max Fun listeners, have given us the chance to do something really cool on behalf of our entire community, and we wanted to tell you about it.
Last summer, following the Max Fun drive, we put all of the enamel pins on sale to $10 and up members, with proceeds going to the National CASA GAL Association for Children.
Your generous support and enthusiasm raised over $100,000. Our bookkeeper, Steph, would be quick to tell me the exact total is $109,025, to be exact.
Your money will go toward pairing kids who've experienced abuse or neglect with court-appointed advocates or guardian ad litem volunteers.
In other words, kids in tough spots will have somebody in their corner. Knowledgeable grown-ups who are on their team through court dates and life upheavals and confusing situations, whatever.
The money we raise together is going to help a lot of kids.
Whether you bought pins or not, you can help us build on that $109,000 foundation. Make a donation to support National CASA GAL and help some of our nation's most vulnerable children at MaximumFun.org/CASA. That's MaximumFun.org/CASA.
And seriously, thank you. Our community rules.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Ify Wadiwe. In the studio with me are
Drea Clark,
Ben Kasulke,
Alonzo Duraldi.
And today we're talking about 1917. Alonzo, would you mind providing a synopsis for the film?
I'm reminded there's an old Mystery Science Theater episode, and I can't remember what the movie is, but there's this long sequence of somebody running, and there's this music playing, and they all start singing, running, running, and running, running, and running, 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 and running, and running, running.
I think I've seen that clip. Yeah. It's so funny.
That's kind of what this movie is. Now, basically, it is about two British enlisted soldiers in World War I, played by Dean Charles Chapman from Game of Thrones and Blinded by the Light, and George McKay from Captain Fantastic. They are assigned to take a vital message across No Man's Land to the front, where a big troop movement is about to happen, but it's a trap. So they've got to stop it from happening. And so along the way, they encounter, you know, abandoned underground barracks and fighter pilots and, you know, all manner of like crazy war shit, and will they make it? And all of this is being told in a way that would suggest, but isn't really, one uninterrupted camera take.
Nice.
Well done.
Oh, yeah.
You really nailed it. Running.
You nailed it in one take.
Yeah, I did.
You also gave away, which I spent the first 20 minutes wondering how I knew the one guy, and then I was like, oh my god, it's Tommen Baratheon. And he like looked so much older and a different hair color, but it was killing me to death that I couldn't figure it out. So if you haven't seen it,
I didn't recognize him at all. And then Dave later was like, oh no, he was the new wave neighbor from Blinded by the Light. It's like, oh,
amazing.
Right, wow. That guy.
I mean, I think we'll kick it off with a question, and I'll ask, do you think this movie says anything that other war films have not already said?
I would say, well, yes and no. At this point, you know what's the adage? There's like seven stories and everyone's just telling them in different ways. And I've seen other war stories, maybe not the same war, but there's other war stories that aim for something immersive and that lets you feel the tension of it. This one was different to me and unexpected in that it often felt more like a thriller than anything else. I loved the shaping of it. I didn't realize how hungry I was for it. Is something that has a, like, someone hands two guys a letter and the entire directive of the movie is you need to get this letter over there. And then you just watch them for 2 hours try to get a letter somewhere as different obstacles come at them. And as simple as that sounds, it allowed itself to grow in complexity, but it also remained very simple. And I was grateful for that. And I don't know if I've seen that in a lot of war stories, but that's why it had kind of that thriller energy for me of like, will this thing get to this place?
Yeah, I definitely was getting the thriller vibe off it as well, because I was just thinking about how World War II, we were making movies during it, like popular movies that we still watch today. And even though those were, to some extent or other, however you want to use the word, propaganda films, you know, they were all about building morale and, you know, encouraging people to enlist or to, you know, buy bonds or whatever, you know, like those movies kind of shaped the way that we think about that war. World War One, I mean, yes, movies were being made, but like, it was earlier on in the process. And so our ideas about movies about World War One usually were made much later and were more questioning. So like, I'm used to movies like Paths of Glory or Gallipoli that are sort of like, you know, this was a war where it's kind of the last gasp of the European aristocracy, and how like the officers really didn't give a shit if the enlisted men died because they were all seen as, you know, replaceable. And so like the fact this movie is about officers getting two enlisted men to go on a mission to save a bunch of other enlisted men, I was like, oh, well, that's different.
Yeah.
You know, so that seemed cool. I wanted to ask you, because to me, as somebody who isn't a big video game player, this movie felt like a first-person video game.
You're asking all the right questions.
And so I want to hear your take on this, please.
Yeah, the whole time I was watching, so the current Battlefield that is in play is Battlefield 5, which takes place during World War II. But the one before it was Battlefield 1 that took place during World War I, which was at the time pretty prolific, because there's not many games. Everyone does World War II when they make a video game. Mm-hmm. Not many people do World War I. So like, people were learning things like, oh, they were using horses? So I will say the moment like they're like beyond the horses, I'm like, oh! They talk about the horses. And
is there an ABAB for mustard gas? Or?
Yeah, and like, and that's one thing that, because it's funny, because as much as I shit on like people who get mad at like seeing women and people of color in World War I, World War II games because of historical accuracy, you do learn a lot, because I think DICE, the company that develops the Battlefield games, tries to do their due diligence of like educating the players on the war. So especially with one, like, you would, if a player died in the story, you would kind of get a snippet of their life, so you can know like these are people to kind of like remove that gamification. And that's one thing that kind of like connected the dots for this movie for me, because you brought up the good point. I haven't seen many war movies, but I feel like a lot of the war movies I have seen have been close enough to World War One and Two to where they're like good guys versus bad guys. And I think this movie did a real good job of kind of like humanizing every aspect of it, of like, these are all humans. Like when they're in the barracks and he sees like the picture of the family, which
the German barracks.
Yeah, the German barracks. And like and at the end, it really makes it hit home as to why like that was such a big moment for him.
So, Benjamin, you're a cinematographer as well as being
a
director.
He is a great cinematographer.
You shot the wonderful Safety Not Guaranteed, which film I'm a big fan of.
Thank you.
From a technical aspect, I mean, I don't know if in movies in general you find yourself, if it's hard for you to lose yourself in a story because you're looking at how things get made. This movie is so much about how it got made how it got assembled. I'm wondering what your experience watching
was. My thing with Deakins is one of my favorites. He's amazing. And I think
Roger Deakins, the DP.
Cinematographer Roger Deakins is amazing. The thing that I love about him, I mean, technically, it's the movies are great. You can IMDb him, and every one of your favorite movies will be on his page.
Yeah.
And he's just been working at such a high level for so long. But the thing that I really love about him is I kind of share this idea of his about sort of like functional cinematography, right? Like you're only making choices that serve the storytelling.
Mm.
And for me, something like this, where in your words, it's sort of like everything about that you hear about this movie is about how it got made. Everybody says, "Oh, it's the illusion of the single take," and yes, but I think it's a choice that's made for a certain reason, and it's a choice that's planned for months and months, and so meticulously planned out and technically put together for a specific reason. And like every moment, I think every day that they went into like 6-8 months of prepping this movie, they have to ask themselves, "Why am I telling the story?" Because everything about this, all these choices are about storytelling and why you would do that. So for me, I'm like watching it, and it's sort of like, I mean, I think it's not jealousy, but it's just like you get to watch a film that is driven by cinematography and preparation and all the things that were not available to me coming up through indie films. Like, you know, Drea and I met at Slam Dance like 14 years ago.
Or more. Yeah.
Or less. I sort of came out of like Slam Dance, Sundance world. And it's like that you never have time. You never have prep time. You never have like the every interview I read with Roger Deakins and Sam Mendes is about the sheer scale of the planning of this. But and like that's cool if you sort of have the engineer brain. And this, I think there's cinematographers that can function as engineers and some that function as artists or whatever.
Yeah.
And then there's this kind of beautiful no man's land in the middle.
Solid pun work.
Thanks. Sexist, but solid. To me, it's like you're watching this and it's sort of like, wow, they found a way to plan out all of these wonderful choices and to ask themselves continually, why are we telling the story? What's important about it in their methods? And then also to create a system of shooting that allows for catching that lightning in a bottle and having moments that I'm sure were not planned that are beautiful. And that's like everything I would want to do as a cinematographer is just question why we're telling the stories we're telling. Why is this story important? Like, I think you having the time to dwell on that and creating the machinery to sort of dwell on why are we doing what we're doing is really important to me. And I think
I want to focus in on that because that the moment you said it, it was like a puzzle piece clicking for me because
it was your Kaiser Soze moment.
Yeah, I was like, oh, yeah. But
limp out of here.
Barbershop quartet, Skokie, Illinois.
But yeah, like, because, you know, I feel like, you know, all of my friends who shoot things after Birdman wanted to do like that one take look. And I think to compare the two, because those are both movies that seem like it was done in one take. Like, it works for Birdman because, like, especially as someone who's done stage production, that's how it feels. Backstage, you're always moving. Mm-hmm. And then the purpose for this, I think that's the purpose. And the point, and what I ended up feeling was that you're always moving. Like there's no need to stop. Yeah. You know,
it's relentless.
And it was the same thing because it was funny because I didn't hear any of the buzz around this, so I didn't. I didn't go in knowing that was the thing. The one take. I'm watching. I'm like, this. Hold on, is this all going like? And I'm like,
that's the best. When I saw Locke, that movie with Tom Hardy, like 20 minutes in, I'm like, is he? is he not going to get out of the car? Is he just going to be driving the whole time? I love that.
I think there was one of my favorite things in reading about this, because it's the kind of movie that, well, if you're me, I'm like, oh, get every, I want all the info in my brain. Yeah, yeah. Almost like I am the person, the jerk who wants like someone to explain the magic trick to me. I'm like, great. Mm. How'd the body end up over there?
Walk me through it.
Yeah. So this one, there were so many things I was holding. It's one of those reasons that I love the hanger of the simple, like, you guys need to get this message over here, because it allowed for all of this sort of virtuosity of technical achievement to become more human, because they weren't trying to like get a bunch of story elements in. Right. So every interaction they had, which I loved, every single person they ran into was a British actor I've had a crush on at one time. I was like, oh, hey, what's up, Andrew Scott? Oh, hey, Colin Firth, it's been a minute. Benedict Cumberbatch, call me. Like, it was ridiculous.
Yeah, the officers are famous.
Oh, yeah.
The officers were wonderful. But it made, but like, to your point of the, actually to Alonzo's point of the expendability of the soldiers, and for me recognizing the officers but none of the troops, I was like, brilliant. This is just such a good trait, a good shorthand. But you actually said something earlier, and this is super low key, and we can then get back into some technical stuff. But a very small thing that stood out to me, we make a lot of points of one of the difficulties of so many war stories we see is that we focus on white male characters. And even in this world, I saw numerous black soldiers.
Oh, yeah.
There was like the one time he has an interaction with a group of other soldiers, they had a Sikh soldier in there. Sikh. Thank you. And just that. And then there is a female that enters into the story that is just put in there to be a different version of the story, but not sexualized, which I appreciated. Yeah. So there's small things of, yes, would I very much like to know that Sikh guy's version of the story?
Right.
For sure. But in this, am I thankful? Again, I don't know if this is fully in the crumbs kind of thing.
It's the reverse of everybody's reactions to Dunkirk, right? Like,
right.
Whereas historically, there was a lot more of a rainbow of skin color on that beach.
That was actually the next point I was going to bring up, because I remember when we talked about, when we brought this up, I said my jokey comment of like, I always feel like period pieces are an excuse to just have all white cast. Mm-hmm. And then I will give credit where credit is due. Sam proved me wrong. He's like, all right, I heard you on Who Shot You, and I gave you one star, and I'm about to show you in the
podcast.
Yeah, take that. But yeah, no, like I really enjoyed it, because even like he had an interaction with the black character smoking the pipe early on, and the Sikh character, and it was funny because when I saw him, I was like, oh, are we gonna get some more of him? And like, you know, and it's funny because it really is a flex when you do it in a movie like this, because this is a movie where you don't have many lines to spare, because you're always moving. You don't have, like, you're always running to. So, yeah, exactly. It was a choice to let the Sikh man have that many lines and also be the final goodbye and also have that conversation with the man with the pipe. Like, that's the kind of consciousness that I think everyone's asking for. We're not asking for you to be like, oh my gosh, and then his partner turned black and he picked up the black partner, and then it's not that, it's just the simple of just
existence.
Oh man, I mean, I could continue talking about this forever, but we don't have forever, and you probably have to finish up your work or on the treadmill or wherever you like to listen to Who Shot You. So let's give our final reviews, and the way we do reviews here is we say, do you screen it, stream it, or skip it? And we'll start with Drea.
Thank you. I'd screen it. I think it's an incredible human story. I think there's so much to appreciate. I mean, you could watch this and just look at the use of composition and negative space and take away something artistically. But no, I thought it was really well done, and a new way and a new thing. I hadn't seen this story before, and I'd definitely not seen it told this way.
Yeah.
I would screen at the biggest, loudest theater you can find. Everyone talks about the one shot, but really it's, you know, to what end? And like, you could make a movie with one shot just to be flashy, but I think they did something.
And people have.
And they have, tons, lots of them. But but this I think goes much deeper, and I think it's about empathy, and it's about being a human being and seeing and feeling and hearing things in real time in a way that we don't see in films and in an environment that's all too common right now. I think there's a reason they made this movie now, and I think there's a reason to humanize what a generation of people went through over 100 years ago, and I think you need to see it big and loud.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say screened it. It's not a movie I love in a lot of ways. I think that I think there are a lot of better movies about this conflict. You know, Joyeux Noël about the 1914 mm-hmm. truce. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's also a Christmas movie. is great, but you know, but like I said, you know, Paths of Glory, Gallipoli, La Grande Illusion. I mean, but yes, I think it demands to be seen in a theater for the craft of it all, which is very impressive.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm also a screen it. It was so funny because I was seeing, like, as you know, it's that time of year. So I was like, did I get a screener for it and all that? And I was like, oh, I didn't. Let me go to the theater. And I sat down in the theater and I was like, what the fuck was I thinking? I was like, This is the film that you see, like, in a theater. Like, I'm so glad I didn't get a screener for it. And then there I wanted to shout out because they also got nominated for VFX, 19, yeah. And so we were talking about it, me and Demi Adejuibe on my Twitch about it, and he actually went to, like, the VFX, I guess, like, showcase.
The Bake Off.
Yeah, they had the Bake Off, went, and he was saying how they used VFX to, like, stitch together the scenes and the transitions, and he was like, so if they did win it on that alone, based on what I saw, I would not be mad. So
I'd give it to him for that dead horse.
Yeah, I mean, whew.
Hey, that's the best use of effects when you don't know they're there.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's the only way. Yeah.
LA Film Critics, it was a runner-up in our editing category.
Ooh.
So take that.
Ooh. Oh, bougie.
I like it.
All right.
That script.
So that was fun, but we'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
If you're looking for a new comedy podcast, why not try the Beef and Dairy Network? It won Best Comedy at the British Podcast Awards in 2017 and 2018. Also, ILO.
There were no horses in this country until the mid to late 60s.
Specialist bovine arse vet.
Both of his eyes are squid's eyes.
Yogurt buffet.
She was married to a bacon farmer who saved her life.
Farm-raised snow leopard.
Download it today. That's the Beef and Dairy Network podcast from MaximumFun.org. Also, maybe start at episode 1 or, weirdly, episode 36, which for some reason requires no knowledge of the rest of the show.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Ify Whiteyway, and in the studio with me are
Alonzo Duraldi,
Ben Kosalki,
Drea Clark.
And as we previously mentioned, 1917 was made to appear that the film was shot all in one take. And this is not the first film to do this. Many films have been shot in one take or just include a shot that runs for an extended amount of time. So we're going to talk about other films who have employed some form of this trick and why filmmakers keep doing it.
Okay. Somebody I know on Twitter, I can't remember if it was Birdman, but after one of these movies was like, hey, directors, I don't buy a ticket so I can be your editor.
No way. Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
What?
Swedish burn.
Oh, yeah. You know, and I don't necessarily subscribe to that point of view, but I can imagine. I think there is. It can be a little frustrating if you're not in the hands of a director that's really doing something with it, if it just feels like they're either showing off or like they're expecting you to do the mathematics of, like, right. What does this mean and why am I looking at that?
Or if it feels more like a gimmick than it is an interesting way to, like, inroad to the story.
Yeah.
I think that's the standout no matter what the gimmick is. Like, there's other films that,
sure.
Like, you mentioned
Locke.
I was like, you mentioned Hardy. Nope, Locke, which is singular. And, like, which actually always reminds me of Buried, which is that's what I was going to say. Tied to this, there's the other branch of films in real time. And that's the Buried is with Ryan Reynolds, and the entire thing's in real time and takes place inside a coffin that he's found himself.
Oh, nice.
It's not one shot, but it's weirdly incredibly well shot for taking all place inside a coffin.
Yeah.
But there's something about, like, those, giving a filmmaker giving themselves a strict parameter for storytelling and then hopefully transcending it so that what they end up with is, oh, I've now given an audience a new way to appreciate or look at something or even appreciate the texture of filmmaking or the language of filmmaking.
No, like Locke apparently was, he used multiple cameras, but it was, they basically literally did that drive from Northern England to London three times and shot the whole thing basically like a play. So Tom Locke is, you know, in this vehicle that's on another vehicle, I guess. But, you know, they're shooting in real time. He's having the conversations with people in real time. And they did it just start to finish three different times and then edited it together to the best bits from each one. But the you look at a movie like, have y'all seen Russian Ark?
Oh, yeah. No. That's on my list. Yeah.
So this
from 2002.
Yeah. Alexander Sokurov, this Russian filmmaker, basically kind of tells this history of Russia by taking us through the Hermitage Palace and Museum.
It's enormous.
And there's like rooms full of people looking at art, rooms full of like.
There's over 2,000 actors.
Yeah, people waltzing. And the whole thing is one uninterrupted take. And they did it. It was they got it on the third take.
Yeah. They did it.
And they were losing the light.
They did it four times total. And it's a real time. It's like 96 minutes or something.
That's a feature, yeah.
Yeah. And that one, there were over 2,000 extras. Three different orchestras.
Oh, yeah.
And each, it's also a period piece. So, like, each section that they're in is a different, because the difference of that one that's even more video game, the, it's like first person.
Yeah.
And it's like a spectral presence. It's sort of a ghost. Like, you are a ghost as a viewer, but he's muttering to himself the whole time
and
he's talking to someone else. So you're going through these huge rooms. There's like these ballrooms with all of these people in period costume and then a different part of time. And they're alluding to different parts of Russian history. So the undertaking of it is bananas, like the technical.
Yeah.
And on a much smaller scale, the other one we were just talking about is Victoria from 2015, which I loved.
It's a caper
movie. It was my staff pick of like last year sometime. But that one was also shot in actually one take. Yeah.
And I read that was the third run through as well.
And they were only budgeted to do three takes. And they actually beforehand had to shoot a version with cuts for the investors. And thankfully, the third take is great. But the difference of that, Victoria, it feels it's very insular and you're very close to them all the time. And Russian Ark, you're sort of further back and you're taking in all these things. Whereas with 1917, like we saw, he did this beautiful mixture of both, largely because, you know, there's a little magical element to the, didn't do it in one take.
Whereas Hitchcock would occasionally just zoom in on somebody's back and rope so they could change
the
canister.
Because
every time
in 1917 that they went into a dark space, I thought of Hitchcock's camera and rope going, it always like dudes with a dark suit coat it would go up against.
Yeah, if there's a puff the of smoke sort of, that fills the screen. Yeah, totally. Remember Time Code?
The Mike Figgis film.
Yes, because that was not only shot in real time all the way through in one take, but it was four screens.
Oh, wow.
The screen was divided into four, and you were following four different cameras.
So it's a split screen with four screens, and all four of them were shooting one take simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So truthfully, that movie doesn't make a ton of... It's very experimental.
Yeah.
But you have to kind of watch it more than once to fully...
See
to follow
what's going on.
Each of the scenes.
Yeah. Eventually, they cross paths with each other, but for a long time, they're all in different things, saying and doing different things entirely.
For sure.
Wow.
Okay, so within that, there's obviously something that's pulling to the siren call to a filmmaker of this one shot. And I think that the long shot is the like entry point to that. And Sam Mendes actually had one of my favorites at the beginning of Spectre, the Bond film he did. There's that whole Day of the Dead sequence, which is so gorgeous and so it's similar to this in that it goes in and out of like intimate moments. There's exteriors into interiors. There's
going around buildings and
stuff. Yes, and I mean it ends with the whole action scene with the helicopter. Like there's just
Then the rest of the movie has
that sequence the rest of the movie does not live up to that opening sequence. But I wonder if like doing something like that of like, ooh, I've got a taste for it now.
Yeah.
I've had chum in the water.
I wonder if it's like, that was their practice run, because that's Roger Deakins as well.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Could be.
That was their, you should let us do this. Look, we sort of did it here.
Yeah. The whole thing with Touch of Evil, where originally Wells does this amazing long, long shot going through the streets of Mexico and across the border into California, and there's a bomb and all this other stuff. And originally they plastered the credits on it, which he was not happy about. And it wasn't until I think the 90s they were able to put together his cut of the film based on his notes and like I think a rough version that he had pieced together, where you finally get to see that whole sequence with nothing obscuring it, you know. And it is amazing because it is that sort of, it's that Hitchcockian thing of like, if the bus blows up, it's not scary. But if you know there's a bomb on the bus, you know, that's what's scary. Yeah. And so this one, it's like, you know this guy.
The first thing you see.
Yeah, this whole long thing. And it's like, you know a thing's going to happen. And it's a question of when and where and all the different literal roadblocks that they're going through. And then you're meeting characters and all this other stuff is being established. And it's breathtaking.
Yeah. No, you see a bomb, a guy with a bomb in the first second, and then he puts it in the back of a car, and you're like, oh, where's the car? Yeah. It's like three tin, help me, the thing that you're like, follow the ball in the three.
Oh, yeah, exactly. The cup game.
Find the baby.
Cup game, find the baby, Ben, do you have any urge to make a...
movie?
Have you ever like, I really, really want to push for a very long take here. And also, I would love to do this as a full movie someday.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to try it as a full movie. Yes. I think that going back to what we were talking about earlier, having the resources to rehearse and you really have to build it. First, the story has to be served by it. So it's finding the right project, but then you really have to build it from the ground up that way. It has to be in service of long takes. You can't just be like, I mean, you can try it, but 9 times out of 10 it's going to get cut. And I've worked with so many directors that are like, we're gonna do it all in one take, and it's jump cut city later. And it's not bad. I mean, it's you know, it's not to slag on those films or those directors or anything. It's just that it's kind of the way it's gone. You have to really have a certain amount of pre-planning and resources to do that. I would love to do it. I've done it before. And I worked with this director, Carl Jacob, did a lot of movies up in northern Minnesota.
I know Carl.
Yeah, Carl. And we did a lot of those. Those were sort of built in. And he's making these very low budget films that there's no one there to say no. And he's making them, most of them in his family's home and his family's like cabins out in the woods in Minnesota. So he knows the environments and he knows the geography. And so he's literally had an entire lifetime to think about this stuff on some level. And that makes it a lot easier. And just like the film crews are 6 people.
Yeah.
So if 4 of them are waiting around for half a day while we figure it out, it's not really a problem. Yeah.
What do you think it does to an audience in terms of barring like putting the bomb in the back of the car, but in general, like, does it create like anxiety or curiosity, or like, what does it do to the viewer?
You know, for me, it's like, I would hope that it's empathy. I mean, like, I think, you know, across the board, it's like if you're telling a story, you have an agenda, regardless of what that is. And if you're telling a story with actors in real time, it's that agenda has to have some sort of human basis to it. And so I would hope if you're not trying to just provoke people for the sake of provocation, that you'd be, you'd be trying to sort of give them an auditory and visual experience in time. That's real time. That's not the trick of the edit.
Oh, well, that was a good discussion about all that.
Did you write down all those films, Iffy?
Yeah.
You're putting them on your list?
Yeah, they're on my list.
You know, Alonzo's going to start giving you quizzes.
I know. He told me. He warned me.
Is there a quiz part of this?
No, there will be.
Oh, boy. Yeah. The doors are locked.
Well, I mean,
the essay question's going to be.
Y'all were dropping all those dope movies. Why don't y'all do one more? Because it's time for our staff picks.
Oh, that's how you segue.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it could be any movie in theaters, streaming, what have you. Benjamin, why don't you start us off?
Can I go with 2?
Of course.
And this is for people in Los Angeles. Film Independent's doing a screening of this year's nominees, and I really, really, really want everyone on here to go see Colwell. And
Tom
The Third
Quinn.
Wife.
It's so good. Yeah. Wait, I'm sorry. I stepped on your
That's
second
all right.
one.
The Third Wife.
Yes.
Ash Mayfair's film. Yeah. I think they're all showing at the ArcLight Carl Culver City. And you can get in with your Film Independent membership. I'm not affiliated with them. I just love those movies. And I know that they're showing on a big screen. And we're talking about seeing things on a
Colwell
big screen.
Colwell was my staff pick a couple weeks ago.
Ooh.
I love it. I met Karen Allen.
Oh, yeah.
And she was the coolest.
So much amazing stuff that makes it to the Spirit Awards and is never heard from again, tragically. And I say this as somebody who's been on that jury. So, like that's been through the heavy vetting. So if something has got a Spirit Award nomination, you should probably see it.
And for some of the issues people might have of the whiteness of the Academy Awards, that the antidote is sort of
absolutely
who gets through the nominees on the Indie Spirits.
I mean, like our man Bong said, it's local.
Yes.
Our local film festival, the Academy Awards. I have one that I'm excited that Alonzo's not doing because I tested the waters earlier. It is Paraguay's entry to the Academy Awards this year, called The Heiresses, and it comes out this week. It should be out when this episode is out. It is about two women in their 50s or 60s. They're a couple, and they've been together for 30-some years and have had some wealth and a comfortable existence in Paraguay. And then slowly they're discovering that, oh, they're running out of money. And the one that's been sheltered the whole time is realizing her partner has been selling their inheritance and just things. And then the partner is taken to prison for fraud. And the kind of sheltered woman left behind has to fend for herself. She starts like basically becoming a de facto taxi driver and meets new people. It's one of the kinds of films that I love so much for the worldview that I've never seen before. It is a coming-of-age story for a woman in her like later years. It is a gay story that has nothing to do with coming out, with battling societal anything. It is just... That happens to be the two main characters. Anyway, The Heiresses. I think it's such a special film, and it will be on like Amazon and iTunes and a small theatrical, but when this comes out.
Nice. I have not seen that, but I've heard very good things. Forgive me if I'm butchering this person's name. Makoto Shinkai, who directed an anime a couple years ago called Your Name, which
I loved
a great movie. He has a new one called Weathering With You, and it is opening Friday in theaters, and it's they are presenting it both in the original Japanese and in an English dub that I have not seen. I watched the OG version. The English dub has Lee Pace, Alison Brie, Riz Ahmed. And it is like Your Name, a movie about star-crossed teenage lovers who have to deal with time and space and supernatural phenomena and, you know, natural disasters. Ooh. But it's gorgeous and the music is great. It's Radwimps again. And if you like Your Name, you should totally check out Weathering With You. It's gorgeous and has some of the just most awe-inspiring rain I've ever seen or heard in a movie.
Twist. Ooh. Iffy, you like anime, huh?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Alonzo is officially a hardcore weeb because he doesn't do dubs. He always does subs. subs over dubs, which is the anime way. So shout out. For me, I'm going to give up my staff pick and do something that isn't quite a movie because I meant to do it for my... what's good, but it's epic because it's narrative and it's great. But my friend Jamie Loftus, who's been on the show without me, has done a 4-part podcast series called My Life in Mensa. When she joined Mensa as a joke for an article and found out that they are evil, right leaning, kind of crazy people. They're not all evil, and it's actually a touching story where
not all men.
I know
not all Mensa,
but yeah.
Boom!
We did it.
Shut it down. We're done here.
But yeah, it's the story how she joined it. It ended up joining this group called The Firehouse, which is a secret Facebook group for Mensa people that's like unmoderated and heavily right-leaning. She's become the most block member. Wow. They hate her, but then they invite her to the annual gathering. So it's her story of her going to that annual gathering where she feels unsafe, and she's, because everyone's just like, we're only meet online. We're nice in person. And like listening to it, it's great. Quirky, and I think it should become a movie because I'd love to see this brought to life. So
what's
check
the title
out.
Of it again?
My Life in Mensa.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. But yeah, I had fun running on the treadmill and checking that out. But before we go, let's read a 5-star review. If you leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, we'll read it on air. This one's from Cordeliaba. This fills the pop culture commentary hole in my life since Entertainment Weekly became monthly. Great insights, smart commentary, and funny. Treya's book recommendations are always spot on, and the whole game helps me fill my movie watch list.
Oh, wow.
Yay! Yay!
Thank you.
Cordelia Bliss.
Yeah.
Great name.
Benjamin, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me on. This is so cool. Amazing. I love this room, too.
Yeah.
This is awesome.
This is also where I record my rap mixtape.
Excellent.
But where can people find you?
A couple things. They can look out. I've got a movie coming out in a few months called Banana Split.
You can look out for that.
Oh, thank you. And that you can find updates on Instagram at Banana Split Movie. And I'm at Benjamin Kasulke on Instagram, BenjaminKasulke.
That will be on
like
the quiz.
Same Twitter tag. And then the website's under construction, but that's www.benkasulke.com. That's a few weeks out still. But that's where you can find me.
Yay. Oh. And when is Banana Split's coming out? Or Split.
Yeah, yes. Not to be confused with Banana Split's movie, which we're all looking forward to seeing, the sci-fi movie, but the sci-fi horror movie.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
This is the opposite of that. We're looking at...
I have to comment. Ben made my favorite female friendship story of the year, and I'm including Booksmart in that. Wow. I loved Banana Split so much. I'm so excited.
Awesome. I'm glad you loved it.
I stepped on it. When is it coming out?
Our distro company people are talking at first quarter of this year. So that translates for everybody on planet Earth as late March, early April, somewhere in there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We'll bring it up again.
Definitely post that thing. Yeah. Thank you for having me. This is awesome.
We also would love for you to call into the Who Shot line. We're running low on messages.
Oh, please
and would
do.
Love to hear from you. So what questions do you have for us? Just call in and let us know. The number is WSY-803-1664. And just a reminder that you can buy a Jumbotron on our show.
Jumbotron!
You get that by going to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. And if you have a comment suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at WhoShotYaPod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/WhoShotYaPodcast. Or send us an email at WhoShotYa@MaximumFun.org.
Iffy, what are we talking about next week?
Oh, next week we're talking about movies that people, they've been shaking the internet. They can't wait. We're talking about Doolittle.
Oh, yeah, we are.
Yeah, yeah. And not the Eddie Murphy one.
Or the Rex Harrison.
Yeah. but with that, go out and watch it so you can tune in and hear our takes and combine it with your takes.
Or maybe don't. Just tune in.
This one will be fine to listen to if you haven't seen the movie,
totally,
I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.